Mike. It's great seeing you again.
Good to see you, Ben.
I'm excited for today. I thought we had a really good conversation about what we've been calling highly underwritten, or what you've been calling, but I've adopted, highly underwritten debt products for D2C brands. And then in contrast to what we're calling, kind of fintech type debt products. So what in your mind would be highly underwritten and what in your mind would be fintech?
Yeah, I think highly underwritten is being your, for lack of a better word, traditional loan types. So anything that a bank is offering, right? A bank term loan, a bank, line of credit, bank revolver. There's a subset of banks that focus on VC-backed companies. So I used to work at one called Bridge Bank, but the Silicon Valley Bank is the big player in the space. So that's another highly underwritten, but they're underwriting a little bit differently. They're underwriting to as much who your VC is as they are the company themselves. So broadly, we call that venture debt. There's some nuances, but broadly, I'd call venture debt highly underwritten. Then there's asset-based lending, which is a very old-fashioned lending, but it's very in-depth. Those are companies that could be banks or non-banks, but they're really focused on the inventory that they're lending against. And there are a ton of controls. We talked about it last time, and it's in the blog post. And then lastly, I would put mezzanine debt into that highly underwritten. And again, we talked about it, but those are, maybe a private equity firm that's investing in behind bank debt and usually looking at a company that's got a ton of positive cash flow. So they're underwriting to, just the predictability and the comfort that cash flow is going to continue. So that's what I would call highly underwritten.
Okay. And so then contrasting that, what would be a fintech, enabled lender or loan product?
Yeah, so there are a couple categories that have evolved, but if I start with just what I think, by what I mean by proactive or programmatic, those are, processes that are a lot less onerous, a lot less in-depth, more standardized. So, regardless of the company going through it, they're looking at the same, criteria. And then also the output, the loan structures that are offered are a lot more standardized. So you can kind of read between the lines there that programmatic is going to tend to be a little bit earlier stage. And that's why we think it's probably a good fit for a lot of D2C e-commerce. They're going to get looked at the same way. They're going to get looked at hopefully more quickly, but there's not going to be a lot of nuance to the end structure. It's going to be a little bit more of a standardized loan product, and we can dig into it more. But there's a whole kind of risk reward aspect that kind of factors into that. But in general, that's where I would put programmatic, and fintech makes a lot of sense there because, and we'll get into the details, but it's all about scale and how do they automate processes and decisioning and things like that. So that's why fintechs kind of fall into that programmatic territory.
Okay. So some common, what would be the common names in the fintech programmatic? I mean, Clearco, Wayflyer, Settle, and
Yeah, exactly. You've got those. You've got on, and we'll get into this in more detail, but on the revenue-based financing side, you've got Pipe and CapChase and Lighter Capital, where I used to be, and Novel Capital, where I am now. So a lot of players in that space. I think you named a few of the others, Settle, Wayflyer. Those are folks that are focused a little bit more specifically on e-commerce. But yeah, a lot of different names in that space, and more coming every day, seemingly.
And then, where would you put the sort of new credit cards, like a Brex, Ramp, those guys?
Yeah, so those are a little bit interesting. I mean, credit cards by themselves aren't super novel, but there are a lot of providers, and Brex is one of the big ones that are kind of bundling that with other kind of productivity tools or you know, banking plus credit cards plus spend management, or so there's a there seems to be more kind of bundling, and that's where these quick decisioning, you know, fintechs are playing. Brex is an interesting one, and some of the other kind of credit cards are interesting in that a lot of them are kind of sizing their credit limits to how much cash you have. So some of those I think are probably better suited for companies that have some VC backing as opposed to a bootstrapped. But, you know, one of the things we alluded to, there's just so much innovation in this space, and things are constantly evolving. So what may be true today, you know, could be totally different, whether Bratz offers, you know, an expanded suite or you know, another credit card provider, integrated credit card provider jumps in.
Well, so what is driving that innovation that you just alluded to?
Yeah, I think there's a few kind of major trends underlying. I mean, first off, you know, in this space, this you know, what we're, you know, focused on here, e-commerce, but you know, if you take a step beyond that and just consider the kind of small and medium-sized business space, that's always been an absolutely huge market, but it's been tough for traditional lenders to make sense of just because there's so much diversity in the types of businesses and what they're selling and who they're selling to. And it's been really hard for those traditional players to both underwrite, but also just source those deals in any kind of meaningful scale. But there's I think kind of three different, you know, items going on or shifts in the landscape. One is just a continued move towards online economy. So there's just way more, you know, providers in the e-commerce spot, as well as, you know, people in sort of the business productivity, you know, SaaS online kind of tools. So just that activity on the online space is putting even more pressure on lenders to figure it out. And then two, there is, you know, alongside that, there are just more and more standardized data providers within the market. So, you know, you think of like Stripe and Square, you think about PayPal and Shopify, and then you think about on the ad spend side, there's Google and Facebook. So there just tend to be these bigger kind of data platforms and more people, you know, linking into those or able, more and more fintechs able to link into that data. So that's a huge prerequisite to, hey, if I want to underwrite and scale, it means I've got to get access to all this data as quickly as possible and as soon in the underwriting process as possible. And then sort of related to that, you know, there's just more and more money going into machine learning models and, you know, artificial intelligence. So I'm an old-fashioned credit guy. These are all things that are meant to make me obsolete. And even in my current role, you know, that's one of my roles is figuring out how do I make myself obsolete. So, you know, a human being could have only processed so many pieces of data anyway. Now you've got, you know, these models that can, you know, go across multiple different data streams, multiple different platforms and pull it all together and you know, in theory, you know, make better credit decisions. So the fact that all three of those things are kind of getting critical mass right now is why I think you're seeing the fintech explosion on the lending front and in particular towards subscription-based and e-commerce companies.
How much does source of funds factor into this? I mean, you know, if you're getting money from a bank, right, their source of funds is deposits, yeah. Incredibly low cost of capital. The flip side is that they're highly regulated because the government has stepped in and said, you know, depositors have protections.
Yeah.
If you're, you know, one of these programmatic lenders, your source of funds is probably a credit fund, I would imagine, you know, somebody sitting in New York or, you know, LA or wherever, billions of dollars, and they're basically lenders to lenders, right? So how much is that? Is that always happened, or is that relatively new also to the landscape?
Well, I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, it's you know, I've I've jumped into it in the last 4 or 5 years, right? So I'm sure there were aspects of it that predate that. But yeah, I think that side, just that the willingness for capital sources to focus on this sector has certainly proliferated. But I think it speaks to a couple things. I mean, one, those tend to be one step away from, you know, the underwriting engine. So they're looking at outcomes. They're looking for seasoning. So when they're, you know, thinking about providing debt facilities to any one of these companies, Novel or Lighter or Settle or anybody else, they're looking for that sort of those proof points. So I think my guess is there's probably two aspects of that. One is, you know, they're still waiting a little bit longer to see if some of these innovative technologies are going to make sense from a credit outcome. And two, they're probably going to charge, they are going to charge more, obviously, than what a bank's, you know, cost of funds are. So that there, whatever side of the equation you want to look at, right? I mean, there's probably a perceived risk there. And so these fintech providers tend to be priced higher than a bank, but it's also driven by the fact that they're paying a higher cost of funds. So I think it's fundamentally about the risk, but, you know, obviously the higher your cost of funds, the higher you've got to charge in order for it to make economic sense.
Right.
And I think related to that, you know, as you get more maturity, then the sources of capital will continue to diversify. Your cost of funds will come down. But, you know, as you see these kind of innovative players, I think that's the challenge that they have, is can they line up sufficient capital at a reasonable cost of funds?
Right. So let's turn to the underwriting process. I think the last time we spoke, you did an awesome job. It's also in the blog post outlining the underwriting process, how to navigate it, how to prepare for it, the pitfalls, the things you can do to put yourself in the best possible position. What's the underwriting process like for programmatic?
Yeah, well, I've hinted at it a bit here in that, you know, a lot of it relies on these data sources. So that's, you know, from the standpoint of an e-commerce provider or any sort of bootstrapped, you know, startup, that's probably attractive because a lot of it, instead of, you know, a traditional bank asking you for your audited financials and your five-year plans, the fintechs are just linking into all of your historical data and using that to kind of predict where the company is going. So from the customer's perspective, the prospect, the company's perspective, it can look like it's a really fast process because there's not as much lift. It's just like, here, give me the credentials to your banking data, give me the credentials to your accounting data, your Shopify data, you know, all of your different data feeds, and we'll figure it out. So that, you know, a lot of the fintechs, and that's how they compete with the traditional lenders, is it's speed to close, right? So from that perspective, it's the underwriting process is a lot simpler. You know, having said that, a lot of these companies, the fundamentals of how they underwrite a company are still the same. You know, they're going to have their kind of initial internal hurdles that any company has to meet in order to be considered for a loan. And then once they clear those hurdles, now it's about, you know, what's the right price? What's the right credit limit? What's the right term? And then to the extent that data can't answer all the questions, there's kind of a last phase, the due diligence phase, where they're still, you know, it's still old fashioned talking on a phone. You know, there's some fintechs who can totally eliminate that. But there's probably a little bit of a risk gap there, right? There's probably a higher chance that they missed something because it was totally data driven. And so then that factors into the second half of the equation. Okay, you've underwritten this company. Now what do you offer them? And if you kind of don't feel like you've fully captured the risk, your ways to mitigate that as a lender are to either give a more conservative amount, a more conservative term, or more aggressive pricing or a higher price. So that's really the trade-off for any bootstrap D2C is, you know, I'm going to probably get a quicker close. I'm probably going to know more quickly, you know, what the offer is. But, you know, the amount's probably going to be a little bit lower and the price is going to be a little bit higher relative to a highly underwritten deal. And I mean, that's probably not that big of a deal to a company because they may not have, you know, qualified for the highly underwritten debt to begin with.
The smaller dollar amount, it, you know, makes a lot of sense. Totally straightforward. Okay. I have less money at risk. A shorter term, like, okay, I get paid back sooner. It's not at risk for as long. How does the higher rate mitigate their risk as a lender thinks about
it? Well, the example I would use would be your merchant cash advances. So again, this is on the blog and on your website in the field guide. But, you know, merchant cash advances are one of the really early kind of debt instruments. It's not even technically debt. It's just, hey, I'll give you this amount, and then I'm going to plug directly into your revenue streams and collect daily until I get paid back. But you can imagine those are so quick. I mean, you can get a facility within probably hours of applying. There's a little bit, I mean, my assumption, I've never worked for one of those companies, but my assumption is that it's a little bit of a spray and pray approach. So you have to charge enough so that, you know, the companies where they actually do really well and pay you back really quick, they get paid back enough on those situations to make up for the higher loss potential on some of the deals where they get it wrong. So it's simply
about, it's not individual. You know, it's not like, I mean, I think that sometimes can be confusing to people. It's the fact that everybody's rates have to be high so that the entire portfolio generates enough money so that at the expected loss rates, they can still make money.
That's right.
I'm going to give Ben at 28%, but Mike, you know, he's getting it at 8%. Ben and Mike have to be basically the same.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, if you compare it to a bank, you know, where a bank's making maybe 5 or 6% at the portfolio level, it's like they can't really afford to have any miss, right? So, you know, because one deal that goes bad and they can't collect back their principal, it wipes out the profits from a big chunk of their portfolio. So it really does go back to the key of, you know, if I'm highly underwritten, it means I'm turning over every rock possible to make sure that, you know, there's very, very low risk of losing money on that any individual deal because your margins are so thin. Whereas on the other side, they're building in a lot of price and cushion to make up for the fact that they're going really fast from an underwriting perspective. But yeah, you're right. Individual versus portfolio returns. That's an important distinction.
I think that's confusing sometimes to people, or it's not obvious, you know, because you'll hear people compare rates, you know, so they'll be like, oh, this is like a 20%. Like I have a credit card that's lower than that. Or, you know, this rate is a 15% and I can do, you know, my mortgage is at 3.5 or whatever. Yeah. And I think it's often not clear to people that, you know, it's the source of capital, it's the level of underwriting, it's the security, it's the whole package, which then determines it. And, you know, I think that also then leads to, like, you also, as a D2C business, particularly in your earlier stages, you don't qualify for a lot of these other products. So, you know, it doesn't matter that the bank loan that your buddy got is 5% because you're never going to get one. So,
yeah, I mean, that's really the important part. But I think one of the things you're hinting at there is important to call out, which is a lot of these new products, you know, revenue-based financing and merchant cash advances. And, you know, I'm sure there are lots of companies out there who, you know, have their own unique brand. But anything where you're getting paid back as a percentage of your revenues, which, you know, that's you know, the last two companies I've worked for, that's what we focus on. Those, it creates a challenge for the entrepreneur, which is getting to that apples to apples comparison. So if you're looking at one that's a traditional term loan, and let's say that interest rate is, or a credit card, and it's 20%, and then you look at an MCA and it says, well, you can get $100,000 and you only have to pay me back $110,000. It's tempting, and you know, for that entrepreneur to say, oh, that's only a 10% interest rate, you know, $10,000 fee, but I'm getting $100,000. And that's not really accurate, because the rate at which you repay is dependent on where your revenue is and how much of the, you know, how much of that revenue they take as their daily repayment. So you do need to do some modeling, because you could, in that example, the $100,000, they could set the repayment rate such that you pay it back in 3 months. Well, now you've paid $10,000 on 3 month money, not 12 month.
Right.
So now it's, you know, easy math. Now it's a 40% implied rate.
Right.
So that is what happens with MCA a lot of times. And then RBF is similar in how it's structured, but RBF typically has a much longer planned payback, which is, you know, could be anywhere up to 3-4 years.
Right.
But conceptually, that's an important distinction that you need to take into consideration if you're comparing two different facilities, particularly if you're comparing a term loan with a stated interest rate versus a revenue based loan that's just a flat fee based on a percentage.
Yep. I'm going to jump ahead a little, but because I think that this gets to another key thing when people, they get caught in comparing the wrong things or not prioritizing how to think about these products for their own business. And what we've noticed is that everybody likes to talk about rate as the first thing, you know, like, oh yeah, it's, yeah, you know, my effective rate is this, or the rate is, you know, whatever. And what we counsel is it's really the matching of the cash to the cash needs of your business that should be your primary consideration, and then rate, you know, is, and a bunch of other things after that. But there's no point getting a great rate if you don't get enough money, or a great, you know, rate if you're paying it back super quick or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think that last one tends to be the bigger sticking point. It's the tying of the repayment of the loan with the incremental cash flow that's being generated by the proceeds of that loan. So that's a big concept, and there's a lot that goes into that. But the simple example is, if you take out a $100,000 loan and it's to buy inventory, and that inventory takes you a month to sell, that's great. But then what do you do the next month when you need to buy another $100,000? You've now taken out maybe a term loan for $100,000, but it's not a working capital product. So there's a difference there. And the problem is if you take out you know, a short term MCA and you're planning to spend it on, let's say, ad spend, and you think that's going to generate an extra, you know, $20,000 in monthly sales. Okay, well, what's the incremental cash flow that you're going to get off of the $20,000, and how long is it going to take you, you know, to generate those kind of increased monthly averages? And there could be a very realistic scenario where you're paying back that loan in 3 months, but the incremental cash flow you're expecting to generate off of that funds takes you like 6 months. Or said another way, In the time it takes you to pay back that loan, you know, if it costs you $10,000 on that $100,000 loan, to use our earlier example, what if in those 3 months you only generated $6,000 in incremental cash flow, bottom line incremental cash flow? That loan wasn't the right fit. You know, not only did it net you negative $4,000, But if you model that out, you actually find out that you wouldn't even be able to deploy the 100,000 the way you initially wanted to towards ad spend. Because each month you're paying back a third of that plus, you know, the fee over the top. So it is a common issue where, you know, somebody looks at the dollar amount first and says, okay, I needed 100K to spend on ad spend over the next 3 months. Great, this is a $100,000 loan. But they didn't focus on how the repayment structure of that loan was. And when you lay that out and map that out, sometimes they don't overlap the right way.
Yeah.
So that's really the key is, you know, are you going to be able to have the money and deploy the funds in a way that's going to generate excess cash flow in the time frame that you have to repay that loan in excess of the cost of that?
Yeah. Need a good model.
You need a model.
I mean, to put a fine point on that, you know, some of these MCAs, depending on your usage of it, the repayment percentage goes up. So if you're, you know, up at like the 80%+ on your credit utilization, you're paying back as much as 40% on revenues. And I think that's...
On top line,
yeah,
and maybe you're selling a widget that only brings you, you know, 50 cents on the dollar.
Right. So you've like the impact on your cash generation in those following months is dramatic. And you can see business, you know, companies that get themselves into this like debt trap where they take the money, they use it. Like you said, they're not getting paid back. They don't generate incremental cash fast enough to match the payment, and then they've got another shortfall, and so then they got to borrow again, and it just keeps going.
Right.
A good model and discipline will help you avoid that situation. But if for, you know, the founders that are in that situation, like any tips for how to get out?
Well, I mean, and I don't mean to pick on MCA because there are some, you know, scenarios because it is a quick process. There certainly, I'm sure, are scenarios where that math, you know, works. But it's tough. I mean, you're right. It's the best way to avoid that is to model it first and not jump in. Because I think what ends up happening, unfortunately, not only is, you know, do they get it and they realize, oh, this wasn't the best, you know, best capital source. But if they also have a hiccup in their operations, now they've precluded themselves from getting any, you know, interest from any other kind of lender. The kind of middle ground scenario is, like I said, like an RBF compared to an MCA. When I was at Leiter and now at Novel, you will see a lot of companies that come in and they're asking you to take out or refinance their existing MCA debt. And that could be that could be a viable path if you're still growing and, you know, your operating trends are more or less stable or improving, because an RBF is really just a longer term payback. So, you know, you get a longer sort of use out of the funds. So that's the hopeful scenario, but it can turn into a spiral pretty quick. And so I think unless you can get some friends and family money or some other injection to kind of do the same, take out that MCA and kind of break off that cycle, I think the safest bet is to, you know, spend the time to model it. And that's, you know, one of the challenges. It's not fun to go raise money and it's not fun to kind of compare all these different options. And so it does become pretty tempting to take the first offer or that company who says they can turn it around without bugging you and, you know, give you money in 24 hours. But my sort of, you know, caution to folks is, okay, what was worse if you had taken like an extra couple of weeks, maybe with some follow-up calls with the lender and, you know, maybe having to provide more detail to get a structure that's more in line with what you need.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue, you know, spending a a little bit longer time to get the right call is worth going through that.
Yeah.
The trials and tribulations of a debt raise.
So we've modeled it. We've thought about it. We know the risks. We're ready to go ahead, you know, with a programmatic lender. Like, what should we be thinking about now? And how do we make the progress go as smoothly as possible? Get the best result.
Well, this, you know, really goes back to the first, or the prior blog post. There's a lot of good lessons in even that highly underwritten. I'd recommend reading it even if you don't quite qualify, because that's not only is that hopefully the path that you're heading toward. And again, the benefit of the highly underwritten is it's going to be way more individualized structure, way more aligned, and hopefully way better pricing. So everybody should aspire to get to that point. But I do think there are a lot of lessons in that first post that apply across the board. And that's, you know, knowing your numbers, you know, being prepared with backup plans. Anytime you're talking to somebody like me, and I mentioned this on the last podcast, it's like, I'm a downside oriented guy because, you know, if I guess right, I make my 10%. If I guess wrong, I lose all the principal, right, on an individual credit. So talking to somebody who's understanding of, hey, these are the levers that I know I can turn, and these are the KPIs I'm watching for. That's hugely important. But I think related to the programmatic side, you know, we talked about assessing cost of capital. I think, you know, there is something to be said for the reputation that the lender has in the market. You know, so understanding how long they've been doing it, you know, if they have a good track record in the market from a social media standpoint, and not to sell against myself, but, you know, obviously there are players in that are further up, you know, that like Shopify and Amazon and folks like that, that are, you know, they're huge. So there's probably pluses and minuses there from a reputation standpoint. But I think also understanding, you know, am I dealing with a lender, a fintech that's a generalist, or are they a specialist? Are they, you know, solely focused on e-commerce, or are they, you know, are they a SaaS based, but they'll consider the occasional e-commerce? You know, those are things to take into account, not just for the initial underwriting, but the ongoing relationship. You know, if the company kind of understands what you do, better chance that they're going to continue to want to work with you going forward. So there's some benefits to, you know, having those face-to-face conversations with companies and hearing the questions they ask. And, you know, there's some benefit to the entrepreneur. I mean, it's your opportunity to sort of interview the lender at the same point and get a sense for, are these guys fly by night, or are they in it? You know, is it a transactional play, or is it a relationship that they're trying to build?
Do you think that the lender would, do you think there's a difference in how they treat troubled loans or troubled borrowers in the size of the lender? You know, for example, is Shopify or Amazon or PayPal going to be much faster to just like cut you off and, you know, send you, you know, to your fate, as opposed to the lender that's got a 100 or 200 million portfolio? My theory being, or my hypothesis being, is that Amazon is like, I don't care, right? I'm going to, you know, I have like somebody else to answer to. Whereas the $200 million portfolio is like, oh my God, I don't want to report a loss. I'll do anything I can to help these guys out and we get through it. Or are they like even more sensitive to it? Do you have any background on that?
I would be guessing on the bigger guys, because I haven't worked that angle, at least at the programmatic size. But I think your hunch is probably accurate. I think if your lender is someone who knows the space and is really trying to build a long-standing relationship, it's more likely that they take reputation risk more seriously. Meaning, if and this is going to happen. So, you know, I don't mean to like any lender is going to have some problem credits, and you know, some of the outcomes are not going to be great for the entrepreneur, and that entrepreneur is probably going to hate that lender going forward. So there's no way to completely eliminate that. Unfortunately, it's just, you know, it's a spectrum of possibilities, right? But a lot of these fintechs are really conscious of, you know, their reputation, and they need to be, because if you know, all of a sudden there's bad press, they're not on the same footing as, you know, Amazon or Shopify, who have a million different revenue streams. I would think that, you know, your smaller, you know, scrappier fintechs are probably more likely to want to work with you through a problem. But I also think it's a function of, you know, how well do they know your business model, and how well do they know your industry?
Right.
If they're a generalist, it's possible that they just don't quite get it, and they freak out at the wrong thing.
Right. You made a good point about you know, the terms of these loans or whatever you want to call them are completely in the favor of the capital provider, and you know, when I read through them, they're almost always like, we can change them at any time for any reason, you know. Best of luck, right? So obviously they don't want to do that, but if they're in a jam, you know, they can. I think, I guess I'm just making the point that, like, you know, maybe borrowers need to be really careful about, like, oftentimes when they need the money the most, the conditions of their business are going to be such that what they thought were capital available to them or at certain rates is not going to be there when they try to call it down. Is there anything that they could do do you try to be proactive about that? Or do you just have to kind of take into consideration?
I mean, first, I'm over here nodding, but I would make a distinction. There are certain products out there where there's what I would call a committed capital amount available. And so that could be, I'll give you a $500,000 facility and you can draw $250,000 now and $250,000 later. There are providers out there who will commit to that. There's levels, right? There are some who will say it's yours when you want it. And maybe there's a window, you know, you need to draw it in the next 6 months or next 12 months. But the bar to clear to get access to that second tranche of 250 is pretty low. There are others who may say, okay, I'll give you access to that 250, provided that certain key performance metrics are still being met. I put that at sort of the next tier down, you know, and now this becomes a process of negotiation when you're looking at those, like, are those reasonable milestones or you know, funding conditions. Then, way down the list is what I think you're getting at in general, is that a lot of providers will say, hey, you've got this credit limit available to you, and we're constantly taking in your new data, and we're constantly, you know, updating that credit limit. But that's not a committed credit limit. It's a calculation that, to your point, they can, you know, for whatever reason, decide to turn off. And so that can be a problem. I think the other angle to your point is, again, you need a lender who understands your business model. So speaking to D2C e-commerce, a lot of that's going to be highly seasonal. And so your need to build your inventory ahead of sales, ahead of the holiday season, is going to necessitate access to capital. So if you don't have a committed facility and you have a lender who doesn't quite get your seasonality, or they've put, you know, pretty tight performance metrics around your point in time performance, yeah, there's a good chance that you're gonna run into a situation where you can't access the capital when you need it. That's sort of it's very counterproductive if you're the lender, right? Because now you've almost, as the lender, you've almost manufactured a problem that you could have avoided had you just understood their model better. So that's a category where I'd say, you know, that's just a bad lender that didn't know what they were doing. But doesn't help the entrepreneur who's stuck in the middle of that. So yet again, I go back to, you gotta be able to read those terms in the term sheet before you execute anything and model it out. And by the way, a good lender will help you with that. A good lender will, you know, model it out. And if they're vague or they don't quite know, or they try to model it in a you know, non-seasonal way, and you know your company is super seasonal, those are probably red flags that maybe they don't get what you're trying to accomplish. But yeah, a lot of it is you gotta do that work up front to make sure, again, it's the right fit. And when I say loan structure, that's exactly okay. What I mean. You're gonna have access to it under the conditions and at the timing that you need access.
So is the entrepreneur.
And a lot of these facilities, they're not committed. So that's the biggest thing to keep in mind is, you know, they can pull back that credit limit whenever they want.
So as the entrepreneur, give some thought to how important is committed capital to you. You know, do you anticipate that you might get into a period of economic or business or both related issues that could cause the lender to pull back, or, you know, do you want the certainty of having committed capital and knowing that it'll be there?
And I do, again, I think a lot of it boils down to speed to close. So, you know, I don't think speed to close is the end all be all, but the quicker it is to close, in just my sort of instinctual logical take, is more likely that there is, or less likely that it's going to be perfectly attuned to what you need it
for. Well, because they're going to be conservative.
It's like one size fits all. They're either being conservative or it's one size fits all, and they're trying to build volume, and it's less of a what happens in the future discussion at those shops.
There's an interesting strategy. I don't know how you would do it besides having a good network, but there is an interesting strategy of trying to find these recently launched fintech or programmatic lenders and get into their beta program where they give you basically anything you want.
I knew that was where you're going. And yeah, you might have to always think about the next one. Like, you might only be able to do that for 6 months at a time. But yeah, you're right. There is, as with anything else, there seems to be a tendency to launch fast and be aggressive and then figure some of it out later. I mean, on the lending side. So I'm a risk averse guy, so I try to advise against, or being a little bit longer term in you know, your strategic thinking if you're a lender. But yeah, you might have a point there.
What are some of the things to think about, you know, if you've taken programmatic debt? I mean, you know, one issue that we see people fall into is they kind of make assumptions that, like, oh, I'll take this loan from these guys, and I'll take some from these other guys, and some of them over here, and then I'm going to run these credit cards up. And, you know, so what are some of the things, other things, or, you know, maybe just talk about some risks of it.
I've seen that. It's a challenge. And I think it really is incumbent upon the lender to help the entrepreneur during the kind of closing process of, you know, educating them on that. Because for most of these lenders, they are taking a legal security interest in the assets of your company. And what that means is, you know, as debt, if you think about the kind of cash flow waterfall, typically debt gets paid back first, then unsecured creditors like AP and stuff, then the equity holders. So debt's usually first. And so these lenders, when they sign these deals, they're typically requiring that they're kind of first in line for payback, and they do that through a legal instrument. If you're a senior lender and some other debt kind of provider comes in after you, you might have a legal leg up, but you're just still now, you know, dealing with a company who has a different kind of debt burden, meaning like their repayment situation is different than what you underwrote. So a lot of lenders will say, hey, I need to be in first place from a legal security standpoint, but also you can't take on any more debt because I don't want to be in a situation where now there's three debtors trying to get paid back from the same cash flow. There's another complication with MCA. MCA isn't technically debt from a legal perspective, but they MCA providers they're attached at almost at the top of the waterfall because they're tying into your Shopify or whatever, and they're getting, you know, their daily payments. So any other kind of debt provider doesn't like playing with MCA. They don't want any other MCA. So what could happen? You could decide, okay, well, screw it. I'll roll the dice and, you know, I'll take on debt from Settle or you know, Lighter Capital or Novel, and then I'll take on an MCA after the fact. Well, now you're in default of the agreement with your senior lender. They can do a lot of things to, you know, try to get their money back. And, you know, back to the earlier point of, like, you know, things to keep in mind during the underwriting process. I mean, character is the biggest thing. So, you know, that doesn't bode well for a long-term relationship if you sort of immediately, you know, as the entrepreneur, you know, kind of break the rules. So there's a lot of reasons why you need to
ignorance
back to your
no
kind of big picture question.
Excuse for breaking the rule, right?
So, right. Yeah. Right. And that's why I'm saying, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's in the fine print of the documents. And like I said, any good lender should be upfront about that and educating. But when in doubt, assume there's going to be an issue taking multiple forms of debt without at least getting the consent of your current debt provider. And it can get really messy if you have multiple, not to mention the fact that it just, you know, now you've created an extra burden for yourself. So yeah, the advice would be careful. If you are considering taking on another form of debt, talk to your existing lenders first and understand if it's allowed, under what conditions it's allowed. And, or if you just have another, you know, better deal, talk to that new lender about taking out the existing debt. So, you know, there are ways around it. You just need to be thoughtful, and you don't want to run into a situation where you're in default of your lender's agreement, because first thing that goes out the window is the long-term relationship. The next thing that's at risk is your short-term viability if the lender feels like they need to take action to try to get out of the situation. But yeah, traditionally MCA is one of the tougher ones because it's hard for traditional lenders to, or even, you know, other fintechs to stay in front of that, since the MCA provider is seeing the cash first and pulling their payments on that.
Do you want to tell me a little bit about Novel? I mean, you've been there 3 weeks, so you must know everything about the company by now.
Yeah. No, I'm super. Thank you for that. I'm super excited. So Novel Capital is it's a revenue based financing. So they're focused on companies that have, you know, recurring, reoccurring, and repeatable cash flows. I am new, and we are, you know, as probably no surprise, constantly evolving, you know, our target markets and the spaces. So there's a lot of good things that are underway. Also looking at, you know, how can we expand beyond just providing capital products? So how can we, you know, how can we provide more value add to our customers? So lots of good things on that front. I'm super excited to be there. And so for anybody out there who's looking for financing, check us out.
Awesome. Mike, thanks so much. Great to see you again. Really appreciate you making the time.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Ben.